Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Turmoil in the Arab world and the Middle West this week. Libya, Wisconsin, and more. Libyan President Muammar Gaddafi cracked down hard, rambling and raving as the rebellion went on.
Take the rats, the greasy rats, out of the streets. If we have to use the force, then we'll use it.
Still no quorum in Wisconsin's Senate, but Governor Scott Walker's incendiary bill passed the state assembly.
All in favor say aye, all opposed say nay. The ayes have it, the bill is in the Senate. The assembly is adjourned.
And the Space Shuttle Discovery, first launch in 1984, lifted off on its final journey, the beginning of the end for the shuttle era.
2, 1, booster ignition, and the final liftoff of Discovery, a tribute to the dedication, hard work, and pride of America's space shuttle team. The shuttle has cleared the tower.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Al Jazeera's Abdurahim Fukara, Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What do you see happening in Libya, Wisconsin, on the Defense of Marriage Act with Somalia's pirates? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. It should be quite the round of news in front of us today, and indeed it is. Clarence Page, thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be here, Tom. How are you?
Very well. Abdurahim Fukara on your cell phone on the way into the studio, I think. So thank you for joining us.
It's good to be with you, and I'm sorry I'm a little late.
That's quite all right, and hello, Jack.
Hi, Tom.
Abdurahim, I hate to catch you on the hoof, but it's your region that Al Jazeera has covered so much and for so long that is on fire in these weeks. What's the latest you see in Libya? What's the state there of the standoff?
Well, the latest we're hearing is that while the supporters of the Libyan leader, Muammar Gaddafi, seem to be trying to consolidate their hold on the capital, Tripoli, we're also seeing some simultaneous movement on the part of his opponents to begin to think about how they could move on Tripoli in an effort to depose him. Eastern Libya, from all the reports that we've had, seems to be under the control of his opponents. The main city in eastern Libya, Benghazi, seems to have returned to some degree of normalcy. Part of western Libya, which is obviously the most important part of the country because it has Tripoli, the capital there, the seat of power, it has seen some movement on the part of his opponents over the last 48 hours to consolidate their hold on that part of the country. So now all sides are focused on Tripoli itself.
Does there seem to be at this point, Abdurahim, some way, anyway, that Gaddafi, whatever violence he may employ, could hold on? We see the entire Libyan mission in Geneva has now quit in a public session. French president now saying Gaddafi must go. Could he still hold on?
Well, he could still hold on for some time, and that's certainly what we're hearing from all sorts of people, both outside of Libya but also inside of Libya. He could still hold on for some time, days, probably weeks, but I think there's an emerging consensus that he doesn't really have anywhere else to go after this. His authority, his regime seems to be doomed according to these reports. Now, it's just a question of what price will civilians in a place like Tripoli pay while he tries to resist something that really seems quite inevitable, which is the end of his regime, at least according to various accounts we're getting.
Clarence, Jack, listen with me, if you would, to some interesting sound here. This from Libya, yesterday, morning editions. NPR's Renee Montaigne talked with a Libyan businessman who was right there in Tripoli and fluent in global culture, talking about Gaddafi in an Alamo situation. Here he is.
He's just controlling it from his barracks at the moment. It's basically, it's like the Alamo, you know, right now. He's there.
You picture Gaddafi right now in what amounts to the Alamo.
Exactly.
Well, which suggests you think you will prevail.
The only difference is that we don't have guns. You know, unless his people turn against him from the inside, I think he can hang in there as long as it takes, because he's got all the money with him, and he has all the arms.
Of course, at this point, many have turned against him from the inside and around the country, in the diplomatic service, in the military, in his, even his inner circle. President Obama made his first public remarks on Libya Wednesday with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton at his side. He said he was considering a range of responses.
We strongly condemn the use of violence in Libya. The American people extend our deepest condolences to the families and loved ones of all who've been killed and injured. The suffering and bloodshed is outrageous, and it is unacceptable. So are threats and orders to shoot peaceful protesters and further punish the people of Libya. These actions violate international norms and every standard of common decency.
Clarence Page, it is painful to watch these near massacres in the streets. If this guy is indeed on his way out anyway, what about Washington? Do you see it with the appetite or the means to quickly influence the situation in Libya, Clarence?
Well, it's very difficult because of our tenuous relationship that we've had over the years with Libya. Gaddafi was cooperated in dumping his weapons of mass destruction under pressure from the U.S. because he believed that the same thing was going to happen to him that happened to Saddam Hussein. That's not likely to happen this time. I mean, an invasion. More likely is that his own longtime cronies, the Union of Free Officers, his allies that put him in power and kept him in power turn against him. We don't know how likely that is to happen and who those individuals are, but it's a very difficult situation from the U.S. point of view, except to express profound indignation.
Jack Beatty, of course, you know, there's global revulsion at what's been happening there and suggestions for things that could be done. Swiss government has already been freezing assets. Nick Kristof here in the New York Times saying, well, let's have a safe haven for Libyan pilots ordered to bomb their country, a place they can go and fly and land. Some have already gone out of the country to Malta. Financial sanctions, trade sanctions, a no-fly zone. And Kristof says, Jack, it wouldn't take NATO planes over Libya. Just inform the Libyan military one way or another that if they fly during this crisis, their air force will be destroyed after this crisis. Do you see the rest of the world leaning in here, Jack, or not?
That, I thought, was an ingenious proposal by Kristof. I just don't know how that runs into local politics. One reads, for example, that African states would be very chary of having NATO involved militarily. One reads that the Chinese will not go along with very serious sanctions. And yet I think the capital point that Kristof makes just needs to be underlined. The stakes here are immense. If by bloodbath he can succeed and hold on, that sends a message to China, to Saudi Arabia, wherever, that you can get away with it. He has to fail now, because if he succeeds, it'll essentially mean the moral bankruptcy and impotence of the international community to stop something, and it will send a message, you can get away with anything, even today.
A message that would no doubt be heard first by other leaders in the Arab world who are facing restive populations of their own. Al Jazeera has been watching those. Here's a clip from a report yesterday on protests in Yemen. Amal al-Basha, human rights activist, telling Al Jazeera why she was out in the streets of the Yemeni capital protesting.
For one demand, that is the demand of everybody in this gathering, is to ask the regime, Ali Abdullah Saleh, to leave the country and to leave the system.
Leave the country, leave the system. Abdul Rahim Fakara, what does the outcome of the Libyan situation matter to the rest of the Arab world? How does it play out? What happens in Libya and those watching it across the rest of this region?
Obviously, what happens in Libya is crucial to what's happening elsewhere in the region. I mean, the first thing you have to remember is that people right across the region watching what's coming out of Libya, there's a shock wave. People are really shocked east and west of Libya, in the rest of the Maghreb region, in Egypt, Yemen, in the Gulf. So I think to that extent, the moral authority that any government needs, Gaddafi seems to have lost it, not just inside Libya, but also outside. But now you have this potentially dangerous situation where we saw protests in Tunisia, we saw protests in Egypt, we've seen protests in Bahrain and Yemen, and in none of these protests, protesters have been chanting anti-Western or anti-US slogans. Now, you begin to have a situation in Libya where if the US is seen as taking some sort of military move, whether in the form of a no-fly zone or some sort of coordination with NATO, I think a new element would be introduced into the mix. And remember that both Indonesia and Egypt, both countries share borders with Libya. The situation in those countries after the revolution is still tenuous, and the military in both countries is still trying to pull the situation together. There are still suspicions hovering around the armies in both countries that they're trying to hijack the revolution. And add a U.S. military move in the region, I think it could become more explosive than it has already become in Libya.
Tunisia, Egypt, now perhaps Libya, that would be three. How many do you think governments may fall? We just got 10 seconds before the break, but how many more?
Well, who knows? I mean, this thing, nobody thought it would initially happen in Tunisia. It happened. Nobody thought it would happen in Egypt. It happened. Who knows where it happened? It can happen anywhere else.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a week in the news. Gaddafi's Alamo in Libya, Wisconsin, raging on. Obama says no to the Defense of Marriage Act and much more this hour. Abdulrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera, is with us for the Arabic Channel there. Clarence Page joins us, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and editorial board member at the Chicago Tribune, and our own Jack Beatty. I want to turn to Wisconsin, but just one more word from Libya, because the suffering there has been so severe. Here's one activist in Libya yesterday telling Democracy Now! People there just want basic human rights.
These people just want their freedom. These people just want to live normal life. We just want water. We just want electricity. We just want to live a normal life. We want to go to school. We want to have normal lives as everyone else is living in the whole world. My brothers are being killed in other cities. My sisters are being killed. Massacres are happening. People are dying. People are dying. Just please help us. We're not even asking for animal rights. We're asking for human rights here. Please help us. Please help us.
Please help us. Clarence Page in Washington, we've got very senior State Department officials right now fanning out all across the Arab world, sitting down with presidents and monarchs to talk to them. What do you think they're saying in the countries where revolution has not taken down governments yet? What do you imagine the United States is telling its large network of allies there?
Well, for one thing, they've got to explain why they threw Mubarak under the bus after 30 years of propping him up, because he was such an important ally. The fact that the U.S. decided the time had come to stop propping him up sends nervous tremors across that region over there. And I think that there is a cautionary note being issued to everybody that, hey, your power is not secure, not even in Saudi Arabia or the other countries over there that we have known for so long. Jordan has had tremors there. I think the folks in Syria, obviously Yemen, which holds on remarkably by keeping various factions in the country fighting each other. If they turn on the central government, I don't think that central government will last very long. So I think that the U.S. now, obviously, message number one is that the Bush era is over, the Bush doctrine is over. over. The Obama doctrine, which is still being shaped, if you will, also is pro-democracy, but is more diplomacy-oriented than gunboat-oriented. So that's just my guess as to what they're telling, what the U.S. is telling our allies over there.
Abrahim, same question to you, Abdelrahim. I mean, what at this point, what do they want to hear? What do you think they're asking for? What kind of guarantees can the United States give them when Mubarak has been left and this wave clearly has a power of its own?
I mean, first of all, I have to point out that although Mubarak has stepped down, Mubarak is still the focus of a lot of attention in Egypt, because a lot of people who were protesting in Tahrir Square, they're still wondering what exactly is he up to in Sharm el-Sheikh. He's still in the country. He's not under house arrest. People have seen the example of the former Tunisian president who, after he fled Tunisia and went to Saudi Arabia, 2 days later, his prime minister went on French television. He said, "I spoke to the president." So there are still questions about what role Mubarak is actually still playing in Egyptian politics. And I think that I would imagine that would be part of the conversation that U.S. officials traveling left and right in the region are having with the leaders of those countries.
Incredible. Robert in Nashville, Tennessee, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Robert.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to tell you about, I was on the ship that bombed Gaddafi and killed his daughter. I work in combat information. I gave vectors to the plane.
This was in the Reagan administration when there was the attack on his compound in Tripoli and his young daughter died. What are you thinking as you see what's happening now, Robert?
Well, I see pictures of this little girl that got killed, and it makes me feel horrible. I think we need to be careful about what we ask our people to do, because you have to live with it forever.
Of course, Gaddafi's killing his own people now. We're seeing numbers in the thousands now being reported.
Yeah, and I do feel for all those people. I was also recalled during Desert Storm. We have to save Kuwait back then, and at some point, you know, these people are going to have their own revolution that without us stepping in.
And they're doing just that, Robert. I appreciate your service and your call. Let me get one more. Nola in Acton, Massachusetts. Nola, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I would like your guest to comment more on Bahrain.
Yeah.
I know Libya's horrific, and that's on our scene right now, but I've read that because of its location between Iran and Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. and the Straits of Hormuz, and the potential for problems there if it becomes more Shiite than Sunni.
Yeah, Nola, let us pick it up right there. Abdelrahim Fakara, the Bahraini king in Saudi Arabia this week, talking with the Saudi monarch. What do you imagine that conversation is about? And could the uprising in Bahrain, can it, will it, might it succeed? Or is there just too much with the Fifth Fleet there and Saudi Arabia right across the causeway? Is there just too much counterweight?
Well, let me just predicate everything I would say about Bahrain on this. Every country in the region, and this is what the lesson from these protests, every country in the region is a critical country. Remember, everybody was going around saying, well, Egypt is the pivot of what happens in the region. And then this thing started off in Tunisia. So Tunisia was really a small, not quite so strategic country in the accounts of many. That's actually where the whole thing started, and then it spread to Egypt. And once it spread to Egypt, it was obvious it was going to go elsewhere like fire in a haystack. Now, Bahrain is obviously, it is the home of the U.S. Fifth Fleet. It's close to Iran. It's close to Saudi Arabia, close to the Suez Canal, where oil transits through to the United States and Europe and elsewhere in the world. And then the complication of a place like Bahrain is that its connection with Saudi Arabia. As you know, the Saudis are extremely jittery about Iranian influence. They're extremely jittery about the spread of Shia influence. And As we heard the Bahraini monarch the other day talk about this explosive mix, and now we have this sectarian situation in Bahrain, although his opponents have been saying, we are Bahrainis, we're not Sunnis or Shia, we are Bahrainis and we want change in the country. And to some extent, that's obviously true. They have political grievances, they want a new constitution, they want the powers of the king to be curbed, although many of them actually want to topple the regime altogether and get rid of it. So obviously the U.S. is dealing with a particularly complicated situation in Bahrain. But having said all that, the U.S., a lot of people are saying in the Arab world, has to be on the right side of history. And to them, the right side of history is that the U.S. has propped up, as Clarence said earlier, these dictators for several decades. They're saying that it has been the wrong investment for the United States to make. Now it's time for the United States to make the right investment, invest in democracy and democratic values, something that Americans can understand. The conundrum is, how does the U.S. do that?
Talk about a change up in portfolio and talk about explosive mixes. I've got to bring it home because we have had that and still have it in Wisconsin, right across the border from your Chicago, Clarence. Here's sound of a pro-union activist at the Wisconsin State House just yesterday talking to reporters. This is before the big vote late at night. Here's first the pro-union view.
This is our state. These are our teachers, our nurses, our transit workers. We're not going to get tired because this is our place and we're not going away.
A middle-of-the-night vote in the Wisconsin State Assembly has pushed through the package that Governor Scott Walker there is asking for. At a press conference yesterday, of course, the Senate hasn't voted yet. Still no quorum. Hiding out in Illinois, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker said that workers will be protected under his proposed plans.
Collective bargaining has a fiscal impact. Providing worker protections is something you can do outside of collective bargaining, and we have done for more than 100 years back here.
You don't need collective bargaining. Everything will be fine. Clarence Page, what do you see going on in Wisconsin?
Well, first of all, out of all the millions of words that have been expended talking about Wisconsin, we ought to think of one thing here, that the unions, the government workers, the people of Wisconsin have all been shafted by the spendthrift policies that led up to this and by the collapse of the financial system that led to the current recession. Now the government, state government in Wisconsin, which is not as bad off financially as next door in Illinois, by the way,
by
or California, or most other states. The question is, what do you do about it? Now, Governor Walker is using what, well, Tom Friedman compared to the shock doctrine. He beat me to it because I was thinking the same thing, being that the old Milt Friedman idea or the Rahm Emanuel, for that matter, the idea that don't let a good crisis go to waste. There's a financial crisis going on. Scott Walker was elected as a Tea Party-backed Republican who has been anti-union, hasn't made any secret of that, been anti-collective bargaining. So he's using the financial crisis as justification to get rid of collective bargaining or reduce it down to where it's virtually ineffective, which means the union becomes a social club, essentially. That's why things are really polarized right now. And this has repercussions across the country because other Republican governors, like-minded, including right next door in Indiana and Ohio, are looking to see if Walker can get away with it. In Illinois, where Democrats still run things, the idea of reducing collective bargaining is no longer politically incorrect. I mean, it's actually been mentioned in public by Democratic leaders, not that they're going to do anything like what Scott Walker's done. But this is having national repercussions in terms of a solution to the financial problems that our states and big cities are suffering.
Look into this knot in Wisconsin. Can the governor pull it off? He's got the assembly now with the vote behind him. Still no quorum in the Senate because Democrats out of the state. He's threatening, 1,500 layoffs or something within a couple of days if they don't come back. What's the end game here, Clarence? Is there still pressure enough, any, for him to compromise, or is it, maximum Scott?
Well, as I said on Wayne's World, Wisconsin, Milwaukee's the one city that's had two socialist mayors in its history, and the state also produced Joe McCarthy. I mean, Wisconsin is used to politics from both ends. Scott Walker may be bold enough to see this all the way through to the end and then wind up not getting reelected, but reelection comes several years down the pike. I think he may just be have enough chutzpah that he's going to push everything through right now, right up front, and could possibly succeed in his efforts with just Republican help, unless cooler heads prevail and say, hey, look, this is going to hurt the party in the long run. You're going to get a big backlash in 2012 that's going to help Obama and the Democrats, which I also think is quite likely.
Jack Beatty, has been a week and more now and still raging on. Only one vote, still another to come. Where do you see Wisconsin going? And if it passes, what about the knock-on effect?
Well, that's the, you know, in a way, Wisconsin is the Libya this week. I mean, the knock-on effect could be considerable. In Indiana, for example, a bill I think that has now been sidetracked would have essentially allowed private sector employees in unions to opt out of paying dues. Well, that would effectively end unions for private sector employees. There are similarly drastic measures being contemplated in Oklahoma and Tennessee. So a lot rides on Wisconsin, and it is Wisconsin. I mean, as Clarence said, it's socialist mayors, Bob La Follette, the birth of progressivism. If it can happen there, it can happen anywhere.
On Wisconsin, which is the birth of the Republican Party.
You've got both sides.
That's absolutely right. I'm struck with flashes of candor that are coming through. I mean, Shep Smith, whom I admire a great deal on Fox News, he laid it out. He said, to pretend this is about a fiscal crisis is malarkey. That's Fox News, Shep Smith. And, of course, he's right. The union has conceded on the fiscal issues. This is about power. And Governor Walker, in his phone conversation with the, you know,
the alternative weekly in Buffalo, the alternative reporter there who posed as David Koch, called him up, got right through.
That's right. David Koch, who was his number two contributor to the Walker campaign, to the Koch brothers. In that conversation, he made clear his objective, really, is to essentially make it so that unions seem irrelevant. I mean, after a while, he said, people will stop. Why should I pay my dues if I'm getting so little from it? And he made he completed the circle. The reason you want to do that is that money goes to pay Democratic campaigns. If we want to break the Democrats, this is the way to do it. So this is about power, and it's about using the government to advance a party's political agenda. You know, the Republicans say we're against the government, but here he wants to use the government to break a nexus, a cash nexus with the other party.
But isn't that democracy? Isn't that what democracy does? A party's voted in, and it exercises its agenda. Here's his.
Indeed, it's his right. But I'm saying that but usually the case is governments try to, you know, pass legislation that have some broad social or otherwise economic grounds. This one, it seems to me, or at least on this element of it, the ending of collective bargaining, has a specific political purpose.
Drastic measures, drastic deficits around as well. Anna in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, thanks for calling. You're on the air, Anna.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would like to ask the question, with the Wisconsin law, is it possible to have a recall vote on the governor?
Yes, and he would be eligible for it next year. Isn't that right, Clarence?
I believe so. I'm not going to say it's not going to happen. Wisconsin is getting pretty steamed up on both sides right now.
Abdurrahim Fakhari, you're listening on here. You're with Al Jazeera covering the United States. You know, the Middle East. Well, people are making these comparisons. You know, Cairo, Madison, Tripoli, I don't know, Ripon. What about that? Do you see any connection here, or is it just, a confluence of news, entirely different arenas?
Well, I think the connection is an international connection in the sense that everyone is facing the trials and tribulations of the financial crisis, and they've obviously hit the United States in a different way from what we've seen in the Arab world. And I think it's really a shame that the Arab world is now actually not focused on what's going on in the United States. The Arab world is dealing with the trials and tribulations of revolution it seems to me the United States is dealing with the trials and tribulations of a political system which, despite all its flaws, the flaws that have been talking about after what happened after 9/11 and civil rights and the role of money into political campaigns. It would have been really interesting if the Arab world was in a position to actually follow how the democratic process here in the United States happens, both the good, the bad, and the ugly, at this particular point in time where Arabs are really focused on the issue of democracy.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a staggering earthquake struck Christchurch, New Zealand. 113 dead, more than 200 still missing. Here's a rescuer's desperate plea.
Can you call out to us, please? Hello?
Hello, and what scenes out of Christchurch? Four Americans on a yacht shot and killed by Somali pirates off the coast of Oman as the U.S. Navy sailed just out of reach. Here's Navy Vice Admiral Mark Fox.
Despite immediate steps to provide life-saving care, all four of the American hostages died of their wounds.
And just 5 months out of the White House, Rahm Emanuel was elected as the Windy City's new mayor.
Thank you, Chicago, for this humbling victory. All I can say, you sure know how to make a guy feel at home.
Yeah! We're looking at a week in the news with Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune, Abdurrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera, and our own Jack Beatty. Let's go to Kevin on Interstate 80 near Davenport, Iowa. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes. How y'all doing?
Pretty well. What do you think, Kevin?
Well, you know, I think everybody's overlooking the one point. A lot of the major points is I've been following it all on the news, and these Democrats left the state. They're hiding out in Illinois. They abandoned their posts. They abandoned their jobs. That's not democracy. Democracy was, our country wasn't built on people hiding. If they vote and they're voted down, that's the way it goes. The people of Wisconsin put this Republican governor in office. Okay, if they don't like what he has to say, they'll vote him out next term. That's their right. But for the Democrats to run and hide like cowards, I say, they are stopping the democratic process of America by hiding. They should be impeached, whatever it takes, like one of your other callers from Iowa called and said, oh, can they have a recall election on the governor? The governor's putting his agenda forward. It doesn't matter if she likes it or I like it. But what we do have to stand behind is democracy.
Yeah.
I mean, these Democrats run and hide like this. That's not democracy.
Kevin, we've got it. He's elected. He's in office. They're off the ranch at the moment, hiding out to stop that quorum. I mean, Clarence Page, you write this very clearly. You say in one of your recent columns just a day or two ago, it is the Democrats, you write, who are trying to stand athwart democracy here. He's elected. He's in office. What about it?
Yes, that's right. But they're using democratic procedures to do it, I have to point out, because they're using procedural rules in order to stall. In that way, I was making a very oblique reference to William F. Buckley's definition of conservatism being to stand athwart progress, relentlessly yelling halt. That's what the Democrats are doing right now, the Wisconsin Democrats. But in answer to your caller, there are recall petitions now being circulated against the Democrats up there. Again, as I said earlier, I think I don't want to get into the weeds of all this procedural, emotional, peripheral stuff. The central issue is Wisconsin is broke. How do you pay the bills?
Yep.
And is getting rid of collective bargaining the way to do it? And I have not heard one convincing argument from either side that indicates that they're going to save very much money by getting rid of collective bargaining. That's mostly theory and ideological. And I think that's why you've got these two different arguments going on. But all of a sudden, unions now are being called to account for the financial collapse that they didn't cause by themselves.
Of course. They are in the mix there. We've got a little bit of an excerpt from that prank call to the Wisconsin governor, Scott Walker. This is pranked by a blogger, Ian Murphy, posing as billionaire Republican supporter David Koch. Governor Walker took the call and said there were other Republican governors in the country ready to change collective bargaining. Ian Murphy with BuffaloBeast.com got this.
John's got to stand firm in Ohio. I think we can do the same thing with Rick Scott in Florida. I think Snyder, if he got a little more support, probably could do that in Michigan. I mean, you start going down the list, you know, a lot of us, there's a lot of us new governors who got elected to do something big.
You're the first domino.
Yep. This is our moment.
You're the first domino, the voice of the pranker, Ian Murphy. Of course, the governor thinks it's billionaire David Koch, and he sees and he's ready to and happy to have those dominoes go. He spoke there about John. That's John Kasich, governor of Ohio, who here defended his budget-cutting measures in an appearance on the O'Reilly Factor Wednesday.
What I'm doing is I'm empowering taxpayers. And, in fact, I could also be helping union households because if we don't get jobs created in this state, we've lost 600,000 in the last 10 years. Only California and Michigan has done worse. My job is to lift Ohio for all Ohioans.
And he may follow Wisconsin if it goes against collective bargaining. Jack Beatty, you hear our caller Kevin on the interstate in Iowa saying, look, these guys were elected. This is the way they think is to solve the problem. They're in office. They've got the votes in their legislatures. Stand back. Let's go.
One heard similar arguments about the against the Republican filibusters under President Obama. The president won, the Democrats won. What is this minority doing stopping progress? It's interesting. NPR this morning began with a story about Abraham Lincoln doing just this very thing.
Trying to jump out a window.
Jumping out of a window of the Springfield legislature to prevent a quorum for it. And significantly, the governor, Governor Daniels of Indiana, and Governor Kasich of Ohio, both this week said, look, it's certainly within the rights and within the American tradition of legislators to do exactly what these people in Wisconsin have done. And Kasich said, there have been times in Washington when I wish we could have done that. You know, that is to say, when he was in the minority there, he said, these are very important things in terms of the rights of minorities. So you have two Republican governors effectively defending this Democratic walk-up.
We're going to be watching Wisconsin, I mean, just minute by minute, the country focused there, but many other states may be coming in play here. We've got the big move by the Obama administration this week on the Defense of Marriage Act. This goes back to Bill Clinton's time and the mid-90s. The federal government saying it's a man and a woman, that's the only thing we pay benefits for. Clarence Page, how do you interpret this turn? Obama ordering Justice Department not to defend this anymore. Why?
Yeah, and it's coming right at a time after he backed away from "Don't Ask, Don't Tell," and allowed that to go through. I'm calling this the second wave of the Obama hope and change. The first wave was the really tough nugget, no health care and stimulus packages. And now that they've lost their Democratic majority in both houses, he's going after those ideological issues that pay off the base, which has been waiting impatiently, particularly on issues like gay rights and gay marriage, gays in the military. And it's a gamble because this is going to stimulate, energize the Christian conservatives and all the religious right as we move into the 2012 campaign season, which Karl Rove whipped them up very effectively in 2004, helping George Bush to be handily reelected. Think it's a gamble for the Obama administration, but they obviously see that the winds of change, public opinion has shifted greatly, drastically over the past decade in favor of treating a gay marriage like any other marriage, that it's not going to affect my marriage. Why should I get in the way of other people? I'm glad somebody wants to get legally married these days because the trend is in the other direction.
Maybe a principled stand here, certainly some political calculations as well. Here's the White House Press Secretary Jay Carney talking with reporters about that decision on Wednesday.
The administration will not defend the Defense of Marriage Act in the Second Circuit. Furthermore, the president directed the Attorney General not to defend, because of the decision that it's not constitutional, defend the Defense of Marriage Act in any other circuit, in any other case.
Let's take a call from Mike in Boston. Hi, Mike. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. This is Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you think?
My solution and my concern for the Defense of Marriage Act is that marriage, the government could almost disband marriage completely and become legally responsible to your children as a man and wife on the birth certificate for posterity for the next generation. Why are we even keeping track of marriages? Now, what's going to happen 10 years from now when children who were raised in such an unnatural state decide to turn around and sue the government for $500 billion for putting them in an unnatural situation. The whole country could go bankrupt. I think the baby boomers, X, Y, and Z, me generation, are extremely short-sighted.
Mike, you know, the counter-argument to that is that it's an imposition on civil rights, on human rights, not to allow people to couple and have families.
Extremely short-sighted for posterity, for protecting the next generation. They have every right to have be raised and be placed in a situation with a man and woman as mother and father.
Mike, we've got it loud and clear. Let me hold it right there. I'll put it to our panel. Let me get one more call first, if I may. Omaha, Nebraska. John, you're on the air, John.
Hi. I just wanted to say, you know, although deep down I'm not sure about things with gay issues, but hey, love is love. If people want to get married, I don't care if it's a man and a woman or two guys or two gals. If they're in love and they want to show their love with a marriage, that's cool.
Jack, there's the yay and the nay of it. Mike, absolutely opposed. You know, we're going to pay billions down the road. And you know, John, love is love. I have not heard Republicans making big noise about this yet, but that doesn't mean they won't, Jack. What do you think of Obama's gamble here?
It is a gamble, although I see Mark McKinnon, the Republican strategist, quoted in today's paper saying that, about the anti-gay marriage, that wedge has lost its edge. Well, we'll have to see. I think it does indicate, or at least it augurs, a shift on Obama on gay marriage in particular. He says his views are evolving, and the big step will he run in 2012 coming straight out for gay marriage? And you begin to hear that he might well do that. That now, if that this is a sort of what he's done now on not defending DOMA, that this is a kind of trial balloon. What'll be the reaction to this? Well, if the reaction is muted, only or isolated to the extreme right, he may go on and take the next step, which would be quite a symbolic moment. And not just symbolic, but you know, in response to Mike's heartfelt plea for natural
man
relations
woman marriage,
and so on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, but we see right there the problem that the California cases and the California Supreme Court have addressed, which is finding a rational basis. That's the phrase they use to deny this right to gay people. Now, is it a rational basis to say it's natural to have a man and a woman as parents? Is that nature's only way?
Men, women make babies. There it is.
Yeah. But then we have John saying, wait a minute, people marry for all sorts of reasons, love included.
Yep.
So it's hard to argue that it's not a rational basis in that every reasonable person would have to come to it. And that's the constitutional conundrum here. Mm. And I think that's going to go to the Supreme Court precisely on those grounds.
Abdurrahim Fakhari, here's your region, Al Jazeera's home region, stepping up into Democratic ranks. I'm just curious what you're thinking here when you look at the American democracy, wrestling with an issue like this. If we get Arab democracies and a significant number of them, what are they going to think of this kind of debate in this country now?
Well, obviously, both Clarence and Jack are steeped in the ability to analyze and decipher the nitty-gritty of the American political system and its domestic issues. But it's interesting that Americans are having this debate at this particular point in time when people in the Middle East are going through revolution. The issue of gay life and its various assets is not something that people in the Middle East are talking about in any significant degree. Obviously, gay people have always existed in every country.
Sure.
But in that part of the world, their issues are not being openly debated. But here's the question. Once you actually have a democratic system, let's say the democratic experiment in Egypt does pan out mm-hmm. into a fully fledged democracy, I think you would have a debate about are we happy to have a political system whereby we can hold our leaders accountable if they take us to war or if they squander our wealth? That's the benefit. And Is it a small price to pay to have social issues like this being discussed in the United States, the issue of gay life with all its facets and ramifications? And I think if you see the extent of the crisis in Libya now, I mean, what a time. I'm sure people in the Arab world who may be thinking about the gay issue, they will be saying, if that is what we have to talk about, that is such a small price to do it. Let's do it, but let's have the bigger issue of holding our leaders accountable for what they do or do not do.
I've got to ask you very quickly here, our time is short, about the alleged would-be Saudi young student would-be bomber for George Bush's home and maybe American dams. I don't know what all. If this democracy wave goes on, do we see more of that coming out of the Arab world or less, Abdulrahim?
Well, you know, to the extent that terrorism, I mean, I don't know exactly what all the details of this particular
Nobody
case
does
of
yet.
The Saudi
yeah.
guy. Yeah, we still don't know. But in broad terms, to the extent, as it is argued in the Arab world, to the extent that terrorism and resort to terrorism is the result of Arabs and Muslims not having their own government stand up for their interests. I think if what is going on in the Middle East pans out into something positive, I think it will definitely have a profound effect on the terrorism issue.
One more bit of tape we've got to hear this week. Rahm Emanuel, 55% of the vote, victory in Chicago. Here he is.
We need to confront a budget deficit that threatens our future. Not by burdening Chicagoans and Chicago families with more taxes they cannot afford, but by reinventing city government so city government works for the taxpayers.
No new taxes. Read his lips, Clarence Page. Sounds kind of Republican there. How did he win? How did he do it, Clarence?
By the way, there is what's been called the ROM tax. He wants to tax luxury items while reducing other sales taxes on lower income people.
Okay.
How he's going to do that exactly, though mathematically it doesn't add up, and he's going to run into that problem. But how did he do it? He did it several ways. One, through the dogged old-fashioned retail politics of shaking every hand in town at every subway stop, and also with Barack Obama's backing. Not an endorsement, but another. Good sound bites to put into TV ads.
A swift shift there from the White House to mayor of Chicago. We're going to look more at Chicago next week. So much going on in the world, it's hard to keep up these days. Clarence Page, it's always great to have you right here. Editorial, it's great to have you from the Chicago Tribune. Thank you, Clarence. And Abdulrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera. First time we've had Al Jazeera on this panel, but your region is stepping up in a big way. Thank you for joining us, Abdulrahim.
It's good to be with you, Tom, and good to be with your listeners, too.
Jack Beattie, thanks for joining us, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.